You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538th podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor of 538. With me in the studio, Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. And Neil Payne.
What's up, Chad?
Senior sports writer at
538. That's what they call me.
Both of you are back from San Francisco. Did both of you go to the Super Bowl?
I was at the Super Bowl parties.
That's why you went out there?
No, we did our radio show out there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we did the trifecta on Saturday morning out from Radio Row.
Oh, nice.
Radio Row is like a mythical place to me. What does it actually look like?
This one was just like inside a huge convention center, mm-hmm. and it's just like an open floor plan with like folding tables, like 100 folding tables with a bunch of equipment on them. And what made it fun was that on Friday, Ryan Reynolds was there.
Ooh.
Doing all the car wash, doing all the radio hits.
Did you get him?
No, our show wasn't until Saturday. But did I get him in my camera? Yes.
Excellent.
Many in pictures.
You can see on Instagram?
Yes.
Neil, how was the game itself?
It was great to be in the presence of the game. This was my first Super Bowl that I covered. And it was just like the spectacle was everything that you hear about. And the stadium was so packed that it felt like there was like 1 square foot per person out on the concourse outside of the stands. So, yeah, I had a great time. And the game itself was, if you like defensive struggles, it was an exciting game for most of it. I feel like probably the take from most fans, though, would have been that they wished that the game was better. But we can get to that later.
So Neil's saying if you like boring games, it was exciting.
Right.
I like that logic.
Defense is not boring. As I wrote about the two defenses before the game.
So on today's show, we will go deep, real deep, into the Super Bowl. Is the Denver defense really that good? Does it matter if Cam Newton is really that petulant? And how can Seinfeld help us explain Peyton Manning's postseason career? I have a unified theory of Seinfeld and Manning. And then ESPN's Mike Goodman will join us for our regular check-in of Leicester City in the English Premier League, regular as long as they keep winning at least. Is it time to finally start believing that they are the best team in the league? And then, of course, we will have Allison McCann swing by for significant digits. All right. So the Denver Broncos are Super Bowl champions after a 24-10 drubbing of the Carolina Panthers offense. The Broncos defense swarmed Cam Newton and his offensive line, pressuring him on nearly half of his dropbacks, according to the stats. As a 538 headline put it this week, Cam never had a chance. So we will get to the hottest of the hot takes, all of which involve Cam Newton and his press conference that did not go as journalists and columnists would have liked. But first, let's ease into things and celebrate the Broncos' accomplishment. Here is Michael Smith and Jemele Hill, who are in our theme song, from ESPN's His and Her show, asking whether the Broncos' defense is indeed the best of all time.
Broncos offense, first ever to win a Super Bowl despite getting outgained in every postseason game. Okay? Like, that defense has such a load to carry in a postseason. And I'm not going to sit up here and nitpick about who wasn't there for Pittsburgh or who wasn't there or what wasn't in order for New England. They went up against the MVP, the guy who was so, people had never seen anything like him before. He was scary to a lot of people, this, that, and the other. And they humbled him.
They made him look ordinary.
Yeah. So they belong in the room.
That room is the room where all the best defenses, you know, just hang out.
It's a really, really big room.
Yeah.
It's actually next to Radio Row.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge convention center, and that's where all the historical defenses hang
out. Were they still
out.
Wearing their uniforms? Still the sweat stains?
Of course,
on them?
So we can spot them.
You
can
smell it from Radio Row.
Yeah.
So as I was watching the game, I kept trying to figure out whether the Broncos were really as good as they looked or if the Panthers' offensive line was really that bad, because it seems like do you guys agree we should talk about the pass rush? That seemed to be the key of the defense. So the Panthers' offensive line rank during the regular season was 21st in the league. So convince me why I didn't just watch a weakness be exploited by a strength of the Broncos, obviously, but that, you know, the team they were playing had some effect on what we were seeing. Is it, no?
So yeah, that 21st ranking, that's in sack rate allowed. So they were in the bottom third of the league in terms of allowing the most sacks. But it's also worth noting that when it came to giving up pressure, they weren't so bad. So it was like when Cam Newton during the season was pressured, he gave up sacks more than usual. But you know, they were better at allowing pressure than that number suggested. But in this game, they allowed a ton of pressure, like you said, and the Broncos were the best team at applying pressure during the season. So in that sense, they, you know, this wasn't a horrible team. They were probably an average offensive line if you take kind of both of those metrics together and kind of say that it's partly the quarterback's fault when you allow a sack, but it's partly the offensive line's fault, definitely when they allow pressure. And the Broncos were one of the best at generating that during the season, and they just ran over this sort of, you know, not great but not horrible offensive line.
And it also felt, simply from watching, not having any statistics, that Cam's reactions in the pocket and his vision in the pocket seemed very different in the Super Bowl than having watched him all year. Like, he took that one sack in the first half where it wasn't even on his blind side, and he was kind of looking to the left side of the field, but it was one that you didn't see him take all year long, that he fumbled and then the Broncos pounced on it in the end zone for the first score. So it seemed like a combination of a lot of different things, because the Broncos were, like, the blitz rate was, like, the highest, right, maybe ever, or the amount of pressure.
The blitz rate is actually low.
Right.
It's not the highest in the league, but the pressure rate is.
Right, the pressure rate was. But then going into it, as we all talked about, or as I talked about ad nauseum on, like, First Take and Around the Horn, like, Cam was supposed to be really good against the blitz this year. And so it felt like it was like a combo of, like, I don't know what happened to Cam Newton watching him, because he just did not look like the guy we saw all year long.
Well, I think one of the things was, and there's a good piece at Pro Football Focus about this, about how the play calling of Carolina right. really played a role in putting him in a position to fail in a lot of ways. Like, you know, Carolina, they had been blowing the doors off people, especially late in the season, throughout the year. They didn't really find themselves trailing that much. And so, you know, in that situation, you run the ball and then you run the ball some more, and you're able to kind of do the old thing of running to set up the pass. And in this case, they seemed to kind of abandon the run very early in the game, even though the game was still close, and they thought, you know, let's just put everything on Cam Newton. And there were some quotes from players on Denver after the game about how they were surprised at how almost like primitive the Carolina passing attack was stylistically or schematically compared to the way that their running game is so complex. And they didn't really run a lot of read options. They didn't really put Cam Newton in a position where he could use his legs. And when he did use his legs, he actually had a pretty good rushing game. It just didn't happen that much. He only ran the ball six times for 45 yards. And the other running backs on Carolina, or I should say the running backs, just didn't have a very good game. They didn't establish that identity of running the ball that seemed to be something that Carolina's success was predicated on during the season.
Yeah, you kind of kept watching thinking, okay, can they please at least have a receiver run a crossing route or do something underneath, or have them run the option, or have Cam, you know, do what he does best. But he was taking so much pressure and so many hits that it kind of felt like you watching him on the sideline or watching him anywhere, that having him run would mean that he was just completely ineffective by like late third quarter too.
To that point, I think during 538's live blog, someone pointed out that the biggest pass gains came out of formations that were run formations when they had extra blockers in, and that they weren't running complex passing routes as a result. And then the other thing I wanted to point out was that, you know, one of the things that was interesting to me as we broke down this game at 538 were the stats on what happens when quarterbacks are pressured. Mm-hmm. And how low QBR drops. Cam Newton's QBR when he was pressured in the Super Bowl was 2.6, which is...
That's out of, on a 0 to 100 scale.
Right, yeah. And so he barely existed as far as a positive impact on the game. Quarterback QBR on average in the league when they were pressured this year was 7.9, which, as Kyle Wagner, our sports editor, put it, is Jamarcus Russell on a bad day. And when you're being, you know, compared to Jamarcus Russell, things aren't going well. And so all the more reason why you should adapt, to Neil's point, your offense and try something different, because you can't allow the pressure to be getting to you. You have to figure out a way to work around it.
And Peyton's QBR when pressured wasn't even much better, right? Wasn't it like 3 point something?
Yeah, I mean, both quarterbacks had awful days.
Right.
If I mean, you like bad games, it was a great game.
Bad
Neil
passing games. And I ran the numbers on this. I'm not sure that what the final standing of it was, but at one point during the game, they were on pace to have the lowest combined quarterback rating relative to the league average that year in any Super Bowl. And it's worth also noting that, you know, Cam Newton actually played better than Peyton Manning did in this game, which kind of does lend credit to the idea of it was just Denver's defense played such a great game.
So before we talk about Peyton and him winning the second Super Bowl, is this the best defense of all time, as so much of the chattering? Are they in the room, Neil? How big is your room?
Well, Neil can answer this in a second, but at this point, it kind of reminds me of the Giants' win over the first win over the Patriots, in terms of, in a lot of ways, like, getting pressure on the quarterback was the only reason the Giants won that Super Bowl.
And David Tyree's helmet.
Yes, and also
the
that.
Super glue on David Tyree's helmet.
And this one, too, I was just so surprised that their blitz rate was so high, because it hadn't been high against New England. And they had gone with different schemes, and so I didn't think they were going to do the same. I thought they were going to do something similar against Cam. So I'm not sure. Tell me if they're the best defense ever, but it almost seems like they were the best blitzing schematic defense at the right moment against a franchise that couldn't, and a quarterback that couldn't quite handle that at that moment.
And that's Wade Phillips just drawing up a great game
the
plan.
The best defensive coordinator ever.
Might, I haven't run the numbers, but there's been, you know, a lot of kind of rehabilitation of his image after, you know, having this rep as this sort of guy that can be a coordinator but not necessarily a good head coach. And we all kind of remember him during those stints. But, I mean, the guy's a fantastic defensive coach. And I don't know if this is the best defense of all time. Statistically, I think a lot of people could say the 2002 Tampa Bay Buccaneers defense that won that Super Bowl and just crushed the Oakland Raiders in the Super Bowl were one of the best. The Steel Curtain defenses of Pittsburgh. There have been, you know, the Seattle Seahawks of a couple of years ago when they did, you know, to Peyton Manning some of the things that the Broncos defense did to Cam Newton. Those are all, you know, in the room, and I think this team is also in the room, and it definitely deserves to be in the room on the basis of just that pass defense, and especially the combination of coverage and just the pressure that they were able to generate with Von Miller and DeMarcus Ware, and just this, you know, unending waves of guys coming off the edges and harassing the quarterback.
What do you think they talk about in the room? Like the new episode of Empire or Downton Abbey? Like what?
Lost.
They're still talking about Lost?
Yeah.
Yeah. They're just like, oh man, those numbers.
It's a really crowded room and they're just talking about Lost.
Yeah. They're all catching up on Netflix. I like that. It's just on loop, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Much like being in The Hatch itself, guys.
That's right.
All
right.
To Peyton Manning. Boring Peyton Manning performance in the actual game, but I want to talk about the legacy end of this without actually speaking about legacy. Or rather, I want to talk about how Manning won this game. Neil, you wrote a piece for 538 that showed that it was sort of like a bizarro Manning's team in some ways, and that the things that Manning's teams are usually good at, and Manning himself is usually good at, was totally flipped and inverted this year. And the things that Manning's teams are usually quite bad at, which is defense, was also flipped and inverted, as we just discussed.
Yeah, Peyton, I mean, so his defenses haven't been horrible by any stretch of the imagination over his career, but they've been average. They, you know, Tom Brady has also played with average defenses over the course of his whole career, which is something that maybe he didn't have the reputation for. So these things can kind of change, and you know, we're trying to paint something with, you know, very broad colors, I guess, in this case. But it was a totally bizarro season, just in the way Peyton's numbers went almost polar opposite to what they had been over the best years of his career. And he kind of paired that with playing on a team in which the defense was, instead of being average, it was one of the best ever. And his rushing support, you know, was pretty good too. And so when you add that all up, it makes for a worse team on paper. That's kind of the weird part of all of it, is, you know, making those gains on defense are kind of offset by having such an awful quarterbacking performance in the trade, but somehow they made it work. And, you know, this was one of the more unique Super Bowl runs that we could think of. And that's all that the Denver players kind of talked about after the game, was about how, you know, nobody believed in us. And everyone says that when they win, especially when they win in an upset. But in this case, it actually was kind of true. Like, people constantly questioned, especially that offense, whether they could score enough points to actually be able to score more points than the other team and technically win the game according to the rules of football.
It feels like nothing actually proves the point of how little control an individual player has over winning a title than how Peyton Manning actually got his second Super Bowl when he was really, really bad and couldn't get his second Super Bowl when he was at an all-time performance level. It's like, no, nothing actually paints the picture of how little, like, a QB, not little compared to what we think a QB influence has over the game than this, when, like, there's absolutely no reason he should have his second Super Bowl.
So, Neil, you called it karma in your piece, but it also reminded me of this old Seinfeld line, which Joe, do you have the clip of that Seinfeld episode?
Yep.
Hello? What? Yeah, sure, I'll do it. I just had something canceled the same weekend. Okay, great. Bye. You know, life is amazing. I just lost a job, and 5 minutes later, get another job, same weekend, same money. You know who you are? Even Steven.
So, I bring that up because, like, it doesn't always work out that way. I think Dan Marino would suggest as much. But it related to what we talk about all the time, which is sort of sample size. And if you just play long enough, these things even out, as that, you know, as that clip maybe suggests. I'm sure Larry David was a big stats head.
Oh, of course. You know, I think, yeah, if you play enough. So there's a stat, we may have talked about it on the podcast in the lead up to the Super Bowl, called the Manning Index, which basically just looks at, like, the pregame Vegas lines or whatever, and tries to figure out how many games in the playoffs that you started as a quarterback were you supposed to win, like, were you expected to win, and compares that to how many games you actually won. And the difference between the two is the Manning Index. And it was called that because Peyton was the worst at it of the Super Bowl era for a long time. He had this reputation for, you know, getting the one seed during the regular season, having home field advantage in the divisional round, and then laying an egg and his team loses. And that's a huge shortfall in the Manning Index. And right now, he has 14 career playoff wins, and his expected wins are 14.8. So he has moved up in the ranks. He's not quite even Steven in it. And it's taken him 27 starts to get to this point, and perhaps all 27 starts we'll ever see of Peyton Manning in his entire playoff career. And you know, speaking to sample size, the leaders in the index, which became even more appropriately named later, the number one is Eli Manning. Hmm. And he has won 3.8 more games in his career of 11 playoff games than you would expect. Joe Flacco is number two, and then you get Joe Montana, Terry Bradshaw, John Elway, Kurt Warner, Trent Dilfer. So, you know, none of these guys really play enough games. But just to take it back, and I'll stop talking after this, but Tom Brady was sort of the superstar of the Manning Index early in his career. He rattled off, what, like each of his first 10 playoff starts he won, including three Super Bowls and another playoff win in his fourth playoff run. So, he was just hugely outperforming. But then now that you see later in his career, ever since then, he's been probably about average, maybe even a little bit below average. And now he has 21 career wins and 19 expected wins, so only a little bit more. So if you play enough, and these guys have played 30 playoff games in their career, or almost 30 a piece, I guess it evens out and you win as much as you're supposed to, but very few quarterbacks get to play that many games enough for it to even out. So you end up with Eli Manning blowing the doors off his expected wins in only 11 career playoff games. I mean,
so basically it's just reinforcing this idea that when we attribute, like, you know, greatness and this clutch performance to somebody like Tom Brady, really it will play out over sample size, possibly, that he is going to diminish in terms of, like, expected win percentage.
Yeah. And you know, you don't make up for lost time by, like, you know, being bad on the back end of your career in order to get to 500 or something like that. But I think, you know, your expected rate of winning going forward probably isn't that much different than your expected rate was going in if you have kind of performed individually at the same level and your teammates, you know, you haven't moved to a new team. And that's something about Peyton Manning is he did win Super Bowls with two different teams and with, you know, entirely different cast of characters. And that has to kind of play into the equation, too, of, you know, being in different situations. It just is fundamentally harder when you're talking about those all-time rankings.
It's just so arbitrary that because John Elway put together a great defense and Von Miller and all these guys, that now Peyton Manning goes from being labeled like a choking and unable to perform to like, oh, like his legacy is set now. That's just so arbitrary.
It's all about the rings, Kate.
It's all about the rings.
Count the rings.
All right. So we've put it off long enough, but we have to talk about the take apocalypse that came down on Cam Newton after his post-game comments after the game. Here's a montage of what Newton said in that post-game conference on Sunday.
No. Got outplayed, bro. Nothing different. No. He told us a lot of things. Nope. They just played better than us. I don't know what you want me to say. We lost.
That was essentially the entirety of his comments during that post-game conference. And so if you've ever listened to Hot Take Down before, you know what came next.
The fact that he sat at that podium disinterested with the hood on and was disrespectful to the media, left his own press conference, that's a disgrace. Cam Newton embarrassed himself. If I'm going to defend Cam on the dabbing and the dancing and having fun, you have to act like a professional. This was an example of Cam Newton acting like a petulant child.
So
can we just, though, the part where he says left his own press conference, like, is this a party he threw for himself? Is this like the equivalent of inviting people over and then leaving your own party?
Also, the
left his own press conference.
I think Deadspin pointed out that he could hear the Broncos press conference through some thin screen. And some Broncos, I think, defenseman was just like totally slagging Cam Newton. And so he was listening to the Broncos trash him even after they had already trashed him on the field. So that voice you heard was Adam Schein, who last week we featured. You may remember him calling Cam very laudatorily the pants-wearing face of the National Football League. And so how quickly the take turns.
How the pants have been removed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just Adam Schein who's saying these things. I mean, even the New York Times got in the game. Columnist Michael Powell wrote, Newton, an ebullient, intelligent, gifted quarterback, decided to act in his moment of truth like a 13-year-old. He slouched and didn't act as well as his teammates, even rookies. So I wanted to ask you guys, is this the perfect take storm? Because it seems like it to me. You have an athlete that is already a feature of a lot of debate around his on the field and off the field behavior and races involved, and we have the biggest game of the year and disrespect, quote unquote, of the press. And I think that's what really vaults it to the next level, that Newton didn't give the press who control the take sphere what they wanted, and all of a sudden you have this whole nastiness that crops up.
I mean, it was a cumulative effect for Newton, not just the press conference behavior, but also during the game, sort of a downward spiral in terms of his responses to certain plays and his demeanor on the sideline, and then on top of that, the press conference.
Right. I mean, we should say, on the field, he was animated in disappointment when disappointing things happened.
Yeah.
It was no different than.
Yeah.
You know,
no, he wasn't like awful, but you could see that this was a cumulative effect. But I'm just so torn on. I do subscribe to the idea that he has built up this persona and wants to be seen as the face of the league, and that does come with some responsibilities. So there is part of me that's like, that wasn't really the best look for him. And I don't know if I think that's like a press and like a media, like, I feel spurned. It's not so much that as much as it is. And I'm because I'm like debating myself in my head as well. Like, we have built up these arbitrary rules for how athletes are supposed to engage after losses and like what it means to be a good loser. And where he didn't fit the definition and the embodiment of what a good loser is. So.
But
Go ahead. Sorry.
You say best look. I mean, that treats him as a brand, which he certainly is. That we should not ignore the commercial aspect.
He has referred to himself in those types of terms.
Right.
But to me, there has to be some space within sports to be disappointed. Like that just has to be allowed. I think any of us, even if we were playing a pickup game of basketball or something, you know, and it got intense, we'd be disappointed after the game if we lost, let's say, depending on who we were playing and what happened. And I think here, obviously, the scale and the scope and the stakes are magnified. So I guess I think it's a bit of a double standard for us as the press and as journalists to ask for access to people's true selves, and then when we're shown a true display of emotion, to jump on it because it wasn't as articulate or as giving as we may want it to be.
Well, it's not really, in fairness, it's not really the press and the media, right? It's just all consumers of sports, because it's not like it's just these 20 people mm-hmm. sitting in that room or 100 people sitting in that room. But I don't know. I mean, it's like in the NBA, if there's a call made, they do not hit, they're not supposed to hit the guy with the technical for his knee-jerk reaction to that call. So I think in sports we do understand in the heat of the moment if athletes are angry or disappointed. I don't think it's too much to ask, because by the time he arrived in that press conference, he was one of the last ones there. We're talking like an hour, 90 minutes plus after the end of the game, where he had time to process, here's what I have to do. And how am I going to present myself in this moment? Now, again, it's compounded by the fact that he could hear the Bronco player. And so I get that. And it's not like I'm like, oh, Cam Newton was awful. I'm just like, I do think that could have been handled better.
Well, first of all, I want to point out that he gave the media exactly what they wanted. They wanted this kind of reaction, or at least certain segments of
he
the
played
media.
Into their hands.
He played exactly into their hands, because they were waiting for, you know, because he had built himself up and kind of, you know, played to his persona of wanting to be this icon, that when he fell, you know, there's nothing that the press loved more than knocking people off pedestals. So I think that he gave everyone exactly what they wanted of him. And also, I mean, the questions that get asked at these press conferences are part of this really like rote, mechanical, I ask this question because I know exactly the answer that I want from you to give me, and you're going to give me this cliche, and it's this agreement that we have, and I'll write it down and put it in my, you know, story that's, you know, Dateline Santa Clara. But like, you know, I would have liked to have known the answers to some of those questions, like what did the Broncos do differently? And I think in some cases, and I don't know that, you know, I'm not putting words in Cam Newton's mouth, but a lot of times coaches and players, when something bad happens in a football game, they'll say, we don't actually know why it happened until we're going to have to look at the tape. We won't see what happened until we go to the tape the next day. So it could be entirely possible that he doesn't know what happened and what caused, you know, the difference from what they saw in their preparation with Denver and what actually transpired on the field. But, you know, that's speculation, and he offered us nothing more substantive than, you know, these clipped one-word responses. And we could have gotten an interesting answer of, you know, what are the X's and O's out of it. But then again, how often do we get interesting X's and O's answers in press conferences with athletes, especially ones who just lost and they put microphones in their faces right. and expect them to kind of keep their composure with, you know, people kind of acting not very composed around them, trying to kind of jostle and get mics in their face. So, you know, that's my take on it. As a first-time Super Bowl coverer in person, I kind of have some sympathy for him, because I was down in the middle of that and I saw just, you know, how the madhouse that it was.
Yeah, and if I could add a few more thoughts, I'm not like upset at Cam Newton. I simply think for his own brand and for what he wants and for the space he wants to get to, it was a hiccup for him. It wasn't great in terms of if he wants to be seen as the fun-loving Superman champion. It was a hiccup. But I've also been to now 4 media days at the Super Bowl. And I remember one year I just stood around Alex Smith, who had been replaced at QB midseason by Colin Kaepernick. And Alex Smith didn't get a podium when the 49ers were at the Super Bowl. And I just stood around him the whole hour. And he got asked, you know, because just a wave of guys and women coming by, he got asked the same question, like, not joking, probably 100 times. And so you do get, you do see this space, especially at the Super Bowl, where the media demands are out of control about what these guys have to do. It's kind of a broken system in a lot of ways. The podium setup, as well as the frequency of it, that doesn't lend itself to helping the athletes be able to communicate really interesting thoughts. And it's, that's not helping the media either. So there could be a larger question about how we process the Super Bowl's media, because it didn't seem, it's been the same way for like 50 years. Almost.
Right, you need like a pool reporter model or something where you can limit the number of people, but maybe that information goes out to everyone.
Right, I mean, there could be interesting ways of trying to change the media model that doesn't lead to like the frustration that you can kind of is justified from Cam.
All right, let's leave it there now that we've moved the onus of responsibility from Cam to us, the people who think too much about sports. And this is it for football, guys, for a long time.
What?
I have to tell you, I'm ecstatic. The moment the Super Bowl ended, I felt more interested in sports. I'm not just being a contrarian. I was like, oh, college basketball is happening. Baseball is coming back. These are sports that, you know, feel that less assaultive to like my sports media diet.
I can't wait to talk about the Mets next week.
Yeah, I think, why not talk now?
Let's do Mets segment.
Well, so we haven't talked Cespedes yet, guys, but we'll hold it. All right, let's move on to soccer. We first talked about Leicester City. My pronunciation, I think, is
well done.
Better. The little football club that could months ago. Back then, we wondered if their early success was possibly sustainable. And here we are a few months later, and they're still on top of the tables. We never talk about the English Premier League without talking to Hot Takedown Senior Associate Global Soccer Correspondent Mike Goodman. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. I like the title.
Hey, yep. Listen, we try and take care of our own here, Mike.
Do you want a promotion? Would you like to be Senior Vice President Global Soccer Correspondent?
Ooh. Let's see how the segment goes, Kate.
Okay.
Let's
not I like that. Fine. Am I Senior Assistant Vice President or Assistant to the Vice President?
We'll figure it out after the kind of info
you
share. You
know, it doesn't matter where they get placed. All right, Mike, welcome back. You're talking about Leicester City, whether we should believe. Let's get to our take. This is Nick Miller from the Guardian Football Weekly podcast telling us why the chasing pack, the other teams in the EPL, don't really stand a chance.
I mean, it looks like they're going to quite literally run away with the title. They're the best team in the league right now, so it shouldn't really matter if they're playing the fourth best team or the 14th or the 20th. They should be expected to win. By the time we get into the final few games of the season, and this could be done.
So, Mike, do the numbers suggest that they really are the best team? Because I feel like when we talked a few months ago, we weren't so certain of that.
Yeah, I still think the numbers are they're lagging behind what Leicester City's doing. I think if you were to look at the way we typically sort of tease these things out, they sort of come in around six or so, which is way above where anybody would have expected them coming into the season, but also not quite as flattering as obviously the table has them in the first place. And it's a little bit of an open question as to whether the numbers are missing something that Leicester are doing, or whether Leicester are just, you know, as happens, sort of overperforming what we'd expect.
So they just beat Man City 3-1, which was a real sort of like eye-opener for folks that maybe they are this good. Mike, before we open it up even further, can you just remind listeners why they're so good? What are they doing?
Okay, so what's amazing about Leicester is how good they are in attack without necessarily having a lot of the ball. Usually you don't see that, at least outside of this season in the Premier League. Usually teams that have the most talent keep the ball the most. They create really good, high-quality chances using ball movement. They slant the field so that the other team doesn't really have a lot of chances to go at the other side. Leicester City are the direct opposite of that. They don't worry about having the ball, but they are extremely good at getting very, very good scoring opportunities quickly. And that's unusual. It's a change. It's not something the Premier League has really seen for several years.
How, though? How are they so good at this? Is this like a style change that they've decided on and they're like, this is how we need to play because of our personnel?
Yeah, almost certainly. It's not unusual for teams that are sort of less loaded with talent to play a counterattacking style. But what usually happens is shooting quickly, you don't necessarily create good scoring opportunities. Mm-hmm. What they've done is it's a combination of personnel and sort of really strong implementation. Is they're fast, they're really, really mobile in midfield, and they have a couple of extremely talented players that just get into those great positions really quickly. They get isolated against defenders, and they get good chances before the defense can kind of recover.
So I remember when we talked earlier, there was like questions of sustainability of that. Does this kind of prove that like if you have good players, even if you're if they're suited to a system, even if that's not the system that is kind of the flavor of what you know smart teams are doing, that you can achieve sustainable results, or are we still kind of dubious on that part too?
Well, so they've always been a little better than what you'd expect them to be sustainably, but not so incredibly out in front that you look at it and sort of chuckle and say, well, of course, they're going to start missing. Now, the question was, you know, that little bit of overperformance, you can sometimes explain away through talent, but you would expect it to be a team that has tremendous amount of resources that do that. Barcelona, for example, does that all the time. They're always better than what we would predict them to be because you just can't comfortably account for, you know, Lionel Messi and Suarez that way when you're modeling. And so it's unusual to see it from Leicester City. And what's happened is their two stars, Vardy and Mahrez, have actually sort of started coming back to the pack a little bit, but they as a team still haven't, which is, you know, it's not insignificant that you're seeing that effect.
Does any of this overperformance have to do with surprise in some way, that their style and that this club?
So, yeah, my theory early on was exactly that, that they had a new manager. He's an accomplished Italian manager, Claudio Ranieri, but he's not one of the – he certainly wasn't like a huge name. He had just come off a couple of months in Greece, and because of Greece's economic problems, it was a disaster. But before, he's coached Chelsea, he's coached Juventus, he's an accomplished manager. But so he came in and they started playing differently. And my interpretation was I thought they were going to struggle in the second half as teams sort of got tape on them, got film on them, adapted and adjusted to what they were doing. And what's happened is they've started tweaking how they play a little bit. They're defending somewhat differently. The goals are starting to come from slightly different places, as I just talked about. So again, it may be that all of this is just sort of us looking for reasons and it comes out in the wash, but it may be that you're looking at sort of little tactical effects that are sort of eking out that extra percent that's very, very hard to sort of pin down when you're looking at it big picture analytically.
So I remember, you know, whenever this comes up in baseball or other sports where a team sort of flies in the face of the stats and does well, it sometimes has the tendency to create like a crisis of confidence among stat heads. Is that something that you're seeing in soccer, or how have the stat heads reacted to this team sort of just flouting everything that seems logical and statistical?
Yeah, what's interesting is I think if you're looking at how sort of people who do modeling are reacting, it's not super unusual to see a team with Leicester City's numbers overperforming this to this degree. It's a little unusual, but it's not super unusual. And a lot of the reason that they're in first has to not only do with how much better they're doing than we predict, but also sort of the weird stuff going on in the league where Chelsea and Man United are struggling and nobody has put in the sort of types of head and shoulders above performance over the course of the first 24, 25 games that usually somebody does. So that's part of it. But I think if you're looking at maybe where we're going to sort of dig back down into the numbers a little bit is almost all of sort of the predictive models missed the fact that Leicester would have been the sixth or seventh best team this year by the numbers. I think they were comfortably predicted in the bottom half of the table.
And now, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah.
And now, Mike, they're favored to win in the betting lines. Claudio Ranieri, who you just mentioned, their manager, says, though, that those betting lines shouldn't be trusted, and we have a bit of audio from him.
Are you a betting man? Because the bookmakers have now made Leicester favourites for the championship for the first time.
I don't believe at the bookmakers. The bookmakers at the beginning said the sack. Ranieri's the first. Then
the bookmakers. So if they were to win, Mike, how rare of an accomplishment, if they were to win the league, finish at the top of the table, how big of an accomplishment would that be in the English Premier League? Is that super rare for someone to come out of nowhere like this?
It would be incredibly rare. I think they were 5,000 to one before the season. I think that's right. I hope you guys learned how to pronounce Leicester, because if they were to go on and win the league, every time anybody who does math calls something unusual for the next 20 years, you're going to hear about Leicester.
The Leicester paradox. The Leicester theorem.
Yeah. It's just, it is that sort of unlikely. I mean, they were not an unpopular pick to be relegated before the season started. And so it's sort of unavoidable that if that happens, you have to look at it and say, okay, did we miss something? It's just, to what degree did we miss it? Maybe we should never be able to predict them first because, you know, prediction is an imperfect science. But you would hope that you would be able to develop something that has some sort of inkling when you're that far off.
So do you agree with the odds now? And do their chances look that good?
I would make them favorite. I think it's very close. Mm-hmm. I think all of the sort of teams in the top four have, I don't know where you want to make the cutoff for a realistic shot, but, you know, they're all above, all four of them have more than like a 10-15% chance of winning the league. I would still make Arsenal the favorites in my mind.
There are still, what, 13 or so games left, is that right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 13, 14, something like that. And that's a lot of room. And this weekend coming up, we have the top four teams play each other. It's Tottenham and Manchester City and Leicester City and Arsenal play. So we'll know a lot more after this weekend. But Arsenal, when they've been healthy, have put together the best form in the league pretty comfortably so far. But they have, they're just coming off a stretch where several of their, most important players were hurt. So if everything comes together for them and they can get back to how they were playing early in the season, I think Arsenal are the favorites. But, Leicester are absolutely realistic contenders right up there.
All right, Mike, we'll have to have you back on when those 13 games are done and we know the finale. The finale of our trilogy, of our Leicester trilogy. I think we need a good subtitle for especially for the final episode.
City. Can they do it? They're doing it. They did it.
Right. Excellent. All right. Mike Goodman, our senior global vice president of associate soccer coverage. Thanks so much for coming on.
All right. Thanks, guys.
And now, as with any show, Allison McCann has swung by to give us our significant digit. Allison, what have you brought for us? What telling number from the world of sports have you brought?
This week I have three, which is the number of years that U.S. Soccer and the Women's National Team Player Association have not had a collective bargaining agreement. They're in the midst of a very icky lawsuit over whether the sort of temporary agreement in place counts as their CBA. That's sort of what U.S. Soccer is arguing, whereas the players are saying this is not the CBA. And it's a very messy situation and could have lots of impacts on what happens in the Women's League and the Olympics this year. This sort of temporary thing expires February 24th and would allow them to strike for the league and the Olympics and giving them lots of leverage this year. So U.S. Soccer is basically suing them and saying that this temporary MOU, I guess, Memorandum of Understanding, is effectively functioning as a CBA, but I just think beyond all of that, it's sort of shocking to me that you have been able to go 3 years, mm-hmm. two Olympics, a World Cup, without a CBA in place.
Does some of this come down to the women's players playing with this old CBA because maybe they didn't have the leverage that they needed or wanted, and now they recognize that they have it? And now's a perfect time to get, especially after what happened with Rapinoe and then canceling the game. And I'm assuming a lot of other things. is it like, okay, now we have the leverage to get this done, as your understanding of it?
Sure. I think there's like a lot of fault on both parties here. One, because I don't think these players should have been playing for 3 years without any sort of agreement in place. I know that these things even, you know, probably takes a year or something at a minimum to get a CBA in place. But 3 years just seems a little bit egregious. And yeah, I think maybe they were waiting for a post-World Cup or something to have this sort of leverage that they need to demand the things that they want. I think it's,
what are the things? What are the demands?
They haven't come out and said what they're bargaining for.
It's not public.
Right, it's not public. So, but I imagine it's the things like pay and turf. And I know a lot of it is, or people are speculating, it's the transportation and accommodations mm-hmm. to be equal to the men's national team.
And how did it work during those 3 years? Like, the players were paid. Was it like they each negotiated their own deal, you know, on their own, and they didn't have the collective power of a union? Or what did the union do? Did they just sit on their hands, or were they negotiating the whole time? How does this happen?
Yeah, exactly. That's sort of what everyone is wondering. So this memorandum of understanding was basically saying, we're going to lean on the old CBA while we work on the terms of the new CBA. So I imagine that they basically were functioning with the old CBA that had expired while we negotiate. And now sort of this lawsuit is over of like how valid is this vague agreement?
They're trying to say that this vague understanding. I mean, whenever you say we have an understanding,
yeah.
Doesn't sound very legally
it's
binding.
Like,
right. But
capital MOU, which I like, which is like, yeah, it's a capital understanding. There's an acronym for this. So, yeah, we'll see how things shake out, but I think it is really interesting for people to see them saying, no, we're not just going to come to agreement during a year that's like, you know, a lot of things are happening in the league and the Olympics and stuff. So
it's only a few more weeks, right? February 24th,
I think you said?
Okay, so we'll be sure to talk about it, I'm sure, however it resolves in a couple weeks. Allison, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That will do it for this week's show. Kate Fagan. A pleasure, despite our Cam Newton run-in.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil Payne.
Hey.
You, as always, were okay, too.
Oh, thank you so much.
At some point, I'll, you know, really hype that
so
up.
We didn't get outplayed?
The Hot Takedown crew did not get outplayed? No. We
don't have to deliver clipped one-word responses.
Exactly. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast man about town is Jody Avergan. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. We got production assistance from Tony Chow. Our intern is Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to review and or rate the program. It helps others discover the show. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.
I mean, it's like, you just have to be like respectful and professional in lots of environments.
Absolutely.
I know you don't have like a media press conference if like you have a bad meeting or whatever, but you can't go around being like,
those environments don't ask me to.
That's what I just said.
To put my entire emotional and physical self into a task and then force me to articulate my disappointment about that task mere minutes after it's finished.
Is he the first athlete in the history of the world to have to go through that emotional turmoil?
No, not
That's
at
what
all.
I'm saying. Like,
but my point is
possible.
That the spectrum of acceptable emotion should include being petulant. That should be an okay emotion. When I'm sick, I'm a pain in the ass to be around, right? My fiance doesn't
you
leave
got
me.
That right.
Mm-hmm. It's just part of what's an acceptable universe of my actions.
Who had the best response and who was the most gracious loser in Super Bowl history? I guess is a question.
I mean, Russell Wilson, who's actually a machine, was good.
Yeah, he's
when
not
they
a,
that's even more unsettling to me.
Being.
Yeah, exactly. I'd rather have someone be petulant than be poised, polished,
I mean,
and well put together all the time.
No, and I totally agree with that. I'm not like, I wish Cam, I'm glad Cam behaved that way, but I'm just saying from in my history of times when I've reacted to things like that, I later realize, like, I regret it. I'm later like, I could have handled that better.
Yeah.
So I don't, I mean, that doesn't mean that it's unacceptable and that it's not human. It's I just like, I remember being like a bad loser. Like, and then later just being like, I could have done that better.
Kate, I think he will regret it. My point is that a player's actions after a disappointing loss should not be fair game for the press to opine on their character and worth. Like, that to me
is too far.
But neither
should dabbing. You know, like, of course. Everything about of course. Cam Newton was held against him.
Absolutely, but
for
it
no
seemed
reason.
Like there was
but
more.
But his
of
emotional
a...
reaction to positive performance was held up as, like, his him being him. So why shouldn't his negative
yeah, if you can
reaction,
it out, you
emotional
be able
reaction?
To take it.
Why shouldn't.
I think that is him being him. My point That's is that what... doesn't impugn his character.
I don't think it does either. I don't think it's a reflection
but,
of who...
But the takes do. The takes do impugn his character.
I don't think that should be a reflection of his character of all time. I do think it is at least giving you some insight into him in the same way like the positive celebration gives you insight into him. And I like it all.